Welcome back to the deep dive. We're here again, ready to sift through a pretty big stack of research articles and biographical details, you know, the kind of stuff that can make your head spin.
And our job, as always, is to synthesize all that down into pure, focused insight for you.
Exactly. And today, we're putting the spotlight on a truly phenomenal musician, someone who really embodies this perfect blend of deep tradition and, explosive modernity. We're talking about Troy Andrews, known everywhere as Trombone Shorty.
Yeah, and our mission here, really, is to map out his journey. How does an artist who's not just from New Orleans, but, like, fundamentally shaped by it, how does he become this massive world-touring act?
Right.
We're talking rock, pop, jazz, funk, hip-hop, all fused together, but, you know, always anchored by that unmistakable New Orleans brass sound.
The research we've looked at is it's incredibly rich, and it really highlights his commitment, not just to his music, his performance, but back to his community, too.
Absolutely.
Born January 2nd, 1986, New Orleans, Louisiana. And, you know, the stage name Trombone Shorty highlights the trombone, obviously.
Yeah.
But the sources, they make it really clear he's more like a triple threat. Master trombonist, yes, but also a seriously skilled trumpet player and a powerful vocalist on top of that.
And what jumps out right away when you look at his career is that he's always kind of juggling these two things, right?
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, he's building this really authentic traditional sound rooted right there in his neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
But at the exact same time, he's collaborating with, some of the biggest names in global music.
Yeah, it's quite the balancing act.
It is. And this mix of cultural ambassadorship and just relentless innovation. It's more than just his career path. It feels like a blueprint, almost,
mm-hmm.
for how you can have deep, deep roots, but use them as a launch pad to just, you know, reach for the stars.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning then. Let's unpack this biography a bit. The story immediately puts Andrews right in the thick of it, the Treme neighborhood. Now, for listeners who might not know New Orleans geography that well, why is Treme so crucial? Why is that specific place so essential to understanding his sound?
Well, Treme,
mm-hmm.
it isn't just another neighborhood. It's really arguably the birthplace, certainly the continuous heartbeat of traditional New Orleans music,
mm-hmm.
especially the brass band tradition, jazz.
Mm-hmm.
It all has deep roots there.
Okay.
It's where things like jazz funerals, second line parades, they originated there. So if you grow up in Treme, music isn't like a hobby you pick up or some distant concept.
Right.
It's literally the rhythm of everyday life. It's in the air.
And when we talk about those cultural events, jazz funerals, second line parades, these aren't just, you know, occasional street parties where this is woven into the fabric of the community.
Oh, absolutely not occasional. These are ongoing cultural institutions.
Yeah.
A jazz funeral, you know, traditionally starts as a solemn march to the cemetery, but then the return trip, that's the second line parade. It's this joyous, exuberant celebration, usually led by a brass band.
And the second line itself.
That refers to the community members, the public, who just spontaneously join in behind the main procession, the band, the social aid and pleasure club members. They form the second line, dancing, celebrating.
Gotcha.
So growing up in that environment, it teaches you musicianship, improvisation, community connection. Right from the start, it's like the source code for New Orleans music.
Oh.
And it's absolutely essential to understanding Shorty's foundation.
And then you look at his family tree and wow. It almost feels like he was preordained for this life.
Doesn't it?
He's one of seven kids born to James Andrews Jr. and Lois Andrews. And this isn't just like a musical family. The sources describe it more like a dynasty spanning generations of New Orleans sound.
That's a perfect word for it, dynasty. The musical credentials just in his immediate and extended family are, well, they're overwhelming.
Like who?
Well, his older brother, James Andrews III, he's a really well-regarded trumpeter and band leader in New Orleans, mm-hmm. a local icon himself.
Okay.
Then his grandfather was the singer and songwriter Jesse Hill, super famous for the hit Oopoopadoo.
Oh, okay. I know that one.
Yeah. And you can go back even further. His great-uncle, Walter Pappus Nilsson, played guitar with the legendary Fats Domino.
Wow. So it's everywhere.
Everywhere. And the list keeps going, even to his cousins, Clint David Andrews, another fantastic musician, and the late Travis Trumpet Black Hill.
Mm.
It's this incredible lineage. It meant he wasn't just hearing music. He was constantly surrounded by, probably critiqued by, high-level professional musicians.
Right. It's like living inside the tradition.
Exactly. This wasn't a house where, you know, they just put on records sometimes.
Mm.
This is a place where music was constantly being made, performed right there in the living room, probably. But what's just as important, and the sources really emphasize this, is the cultural role his parents played. They weren't just parents. They were like anchors for the whole Tremé music community.
Okay, let's talk about his mother, Lois Nelson Andrews. She sounds like an incredible figure.
Oh, absolutely central. A real force of nature in the Tremé scene. She actually earned these titles, Mother of Music and Queen of the Tremé.
Wow.
And her role wasn't just symbolic. She was often the grand marshal, you know, the ceremonial leader for those really important jazz funerals and second line parades. And she used that visibility, that position, to actively champion and encourage young musicians coming up in the neighborhood, including her own kids, of course.
And his father, James Andrews Jr., he reinforced that whole culture right there at home.
Yeah, he was deeply involved, too. He was a member of the Bayou Steppers Social Aid and Pleasure Club. That's one of the groups that actually organizes and facilitates the second lines. And their home, it wasn't just the family hub. It was apparently a regular gathering spot for musician friends, like a nonstop jam session environment.
Just constant music.
Constant immersion. And it was so central to their lives that the family eventually formalized it. They opened a nightclub right there in Tremé called Trombone Shorties.
Named after him even then.
Seems like it. And alongside that, they opened a separate rehearsal and jam space called simply The Space.
It really paints this picture of growing up completely immersed in this, like, cultural and musical ecosystem.
Totally.
And you see how that leads to his, well, frankly, astonishingly early start.
It was incredibly rapid. He started playing trombone, as you mentioned, at age four.
Four
years old. And there's this great little anecdote in the biography about why the trombone. Apparently, he got the instrument from his older brother, James.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because, and I quote, the family already had a trumpet player.
Uh-huh. That's amazing. Practical.
Right. Almost an accidental start on what became his signature instrument.
Mm-hmm. And the legend, it starts building almost right away. He's 4 years old. It's 1990. And he gets invited up on stage by Bo Diddley at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. I mean, what does that kind of thing, that spontaneous high-level interaction at 4 years old, tell you about the New Orleans music scene?
It tells you that talent, real authenticity, it gets recognized immediately there and respected no matter how old you are. Shorty wasn't just, you know, a cute kid. He must have already been proficient enough that a giant like Bo Diddley saw something real and wanted to showcase it.
Incredible.
And it didn't stop there. By the time he was 6 years old, he wasn't just playing in a band. He was leading his own brass band.
At six.
Leading.
Leading.
Yeah. Which shows this almost immediate grasp of, you know, the complex leadership, the arrangement skills, everything required in that brass band setting. Just phenomenal precociousness.
But the sources also point to a really significant tragedy that impacted his path around 1995.
Yes, sadly. His brother Darnell, who was apparently also a very talented trombone player himself.
Oh, wow.
Was tragically shot and killed. And this was, I mean, obviously completely devastating for the family and for Troy, but it also seemed to catalyze a really important period of mentorship from outside the family.
How so?
Well, following Darnell's death, he was really taken under the wing of his manager and friend, Susan Lovejoy Scott. The sources say she acted in loco parentis, basically like a parental figure, providing stability, professional guidance, helping him navigate not just his burgeoning young career, but also that immense grief.
That kind of consistent guidance seems so crucial, especially then. And his formal education, it seems like it mirrored that high-level mentorship track. He went to the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, an OCCA.
Right, a really prestigious arts high school. And his peers there included another future music giant you might know, Jean Baptiste.
Wow, classmates.
Classmates. So that NOCCA experience, it put him in a more formalized training setting, refining the incredible natural talent he already absorbed just by living in Tremé.
And the mentorship continued alongside that.
Well, yeah. He continued to be mentored by absolute icons, like Cyril Neville of the Neville Brothers. Shorty often calls him a second father, which just highlights, again, those deep, almost familial bonds that really underpin the whole New Orleans music community.
It's more than just colleagues.
Much more. So he graduated high school in 2004 from Warren Easton High School. And the sources show that wasn't like a pause. That was the immediate launch pad straight into his professional career. Okay, so now we sort of shift gears, right, from the foundation, the roots, to actually building the career.
Yeah.
And the sources detail this remarkable, almost immediate jump from being this local prodigy to suddenly being an international sideman, right after high school.
Right. I mean, while he was still a teenager, he was already playing professionally. He was a member of the Stooges brass band. They put out an album, It's About Time, back in 2003. So he was already recording.
Mm.
But yeah, 2005 seems like the real inflection point.
Absolutely. In 2005, pretty much right after graduating, Andrews gets snapped up, becomes a featured member of Lenny Kravitz's horn section for a major world tour.
That's a huge leap.
Huge. Think about that contrast, right? 1 minute you're, you know, maybe leading a brass band in a second line down the street. The next, you're on these massive international stages sharing the bill with global rock acts like Aerosmith.
Yeah.
That must have forced him to adapt incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
Taking that, you know, raw, immediate energy of the brass band sound and making it work within the structure the production demands of stadium rock.
And even while doing that, he was already contributing back to the cultural record, wasn't he? That same year, 2005, he shows up in that documentary, Make It Funky.
Yep. Performing alongside New Orleans legends like Kermit Ruffins or Irvin Mayfield.
Mm-hmm.
And also guesting with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band.
Yeah.
So even as he's breaking out internationally, he's still documenting and participating in the very tradition he's starting to innovate upon.
And we can't talk about 2005 New Orleans without mentioning Hurricane Katrina.
No, absolutely not. That context is crucial. And in the wake of that devastation, he got involved with the New Orleans Social Club.
What was that?
It was a group formed specifically to record a benefit album. The goal was to raise funds to support the recovery, specifically for the city's musical community, which was hit so hard.
Right.
So again, it just reinforces this idea that his success, his path, is always tied back to the resilience, the rebuilding, the spirit of New Orleans itself.
And that resilience, that spirit, it definitely drew massive international attention, especially post-Katrina. Now, this next detail you flag, this really underscores his global ascent. In 2006, he's still only 20 years old.
Yeah, incredibly young.
And he starts working with producer Bob Ezrin, legendary producer and U2, at Abbey Road Studios in London.
I mean, just pause on that for a second. Abbey Road, U2, Bob Ezrin. That is a staggering jump in terms of exposure, prestige, everything.
Totally.
Working with artists at that level and a producer like Ezrin, known for huge rack sounds, It must have exposed him to the absolute pinnacle of rock music production, engineering, arrangement.
And it wasn't just studio time, was it? That connection led somewhere very public.
It did. It resulted in this incredibly symbolic, nationally televised performance. It was him with U2 and Green Day performing together at the reopening of the Louisiana Superdome for Monday Night Football that year.
I remember that. It felt huge.
It was huge. And incredibly emotional for New Orleans. It wasn't just a football game. It was a massive statement about the city's comeback after Katrina.
And there's Trombone Shorty, physically standing on that stage, representing the next generation, the future of the city's music.
Exactly. A powerful, powerful moment. And understandably, his profile just went through the roof after things like that.
Which translated into screen time, too, outside of just music documentaries. Yep. He appeared as himself, right, in David Simon's HBO series, Dream.
Yeah, which was perfect casting, obviously. He was in 7 episodes between 2010 and 2013, essentially playing a sort of fictionalized version of his own life and experiences in post-Katrina New Orleans.
Bringing that authenticity right to the screen.
Totally. And he also brought his sound to more mainstream TV. He recorded the theme song for that CBS remake of The Odd Couple in 2015.
Right, I'd forgotten about that. But the most maybe surprising screen credit has to be his feature film debut.
As a voice act.
Isn't that great? Yeah, in 2015, he dipped into voice acting. He provided the voices for the teacher, Miss Othmar, you know, the famous wah, wah, wah voice.
Huh? No way.
Yeah. And apparently all the other adult voices in the Peanuts movie.
That's fantastic. It just shows this incredible range, right? From high drama, cultural TV about New Orleans, to primetime network sitcom themes, to voicing iconic cartoon characters.
It was a completely, like, genre-defying path he was carving out.
Okay, before we dive into his solo success, his albums as a leader, maybe let's pause on this tension you mentioned earlier, which I think really gets to the core insight of this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
You listed his influences, his brother James, Cyril Neville, legends like Wynton Marsalis, Kermit Ruffins, Walter Wolfman, Washington, Alan Toussaint, but also Lenny Kravitz.
Right, a real mix.
Yeah.
So how does he reconcile those? How does he bring together the, say, highly disciplined, maybe more traditionalist jazz approach of someone like Wynton Marsalis with the raw power, the stadium rock production, the demands of playing with Lenny Kravitz?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? And I think the answer, based on the sources and just listening to his music, is that he acts as a genuine synthesizer. He doesn't choose one over the other.
Okay.
So you get someone like Marsalis or Ruffins giving him that deep vocabulary, the technical precision of traditional New Orleans jazz and brass band music, the absolute mastery of the horns.
The chops.
Exactly, the chops.
Yeah.
Then you have figures like Alan Toussaint and Cyril Neville providing that foundation in New Orleans R&B and funk, the groove, the swagger, the rhythmic complexity, that deep pocket.
Right.
And then Lenny Kravitz brings the understanding of, you know, modern production, song arrangement for big audiences, stage presence, the energy needed for global rock stardom.
So he takes elements from all of them.
Precisely. He doesn't compromise one for the other. It's like he uses the discipline he learned from the Marsalis lineage to execute the power and energy demanded by the Kravitz context. And that fusion, that unique blend, that is the Shorty sound.
Okay, so now we can really dig into his solo work as a band leader. The sources show that by 2010, he's armed with all this incredible experience, these diverse influences. He's clearly ready for a major breakthrough on his own terms. Let's talk about the album Back of Town.
Back of Town, yeah, released in 2010. This was undeniably the catalyst, the moment things really exploded for him as a solo artist. And it wasn't just, you know, critics liked it. It was a genuine commercial juggernaut.
How so?
It shot straight to number one on the Billboard Contemporary Jazz chart, which is impressive enough. But then it stayed there for 9 consecutive weeks.
9 weeks at number one for a mostly instrumental genre blending album.
Exactly. That kind of chart domination, that endurance, it tells you something powerful about how much that sound connected with people. It really had broad appeal.
So let's talk about that sound. How did Back of Town and his band Orleans Avenue actually translate that Shorty sound we just defined into something that could achieve that level of commercial success? What were they doing musically?
Well, I think the genius of that album and really his band Orleans Avenue's whole approach is how they structured the music. They take those core New Orleans elements like the driving syncopated polyrhythmic drumming patterns from second line music, and they layer that foundation with like deep funk bass lines, heavy rock guitar riffs. It's muscular.
Okay.
But crucially, the way Shorty plays the trombone, he's not treating it like a traditional jazz horn, all smooth tones and subtle lines. He often plays it more like a rock lead guitar.
Oah, what do you mean?
You hear him using distortion pedals, wah pedals. He's playing these powerful horn-based riffs that have the punch and the feel of rock music. He's taking the power of the brass band tradition, but putting it firmly into this contemporary, almost arena rock context.
So it grabs you.
It absolutely grabs you. It's impossible to ignore, which is probably why it resonated so strongly and stayed on the charts for so long.
And that chart success, naturally, it translated into just relentless international touring.
Oh, yeah. He took Orleans Avenue everywhere. The sources list Australia, North America, Europe, Japan, Brazil. Plus, he was landing these major support slots, opening for huge established acts like Jeff Beck, the Dave Matthews Band.
Getting in front of massive audiences.
Massive, diverse audiences. And the mainstream recognition followed immediately. He started appearing on national television constantly. You saw him on Conan, Letterman, Jay Leno, Jimmy Kimmel Live.
All the big ones.
All of them. This wasn't some niche marketing campaign. This was genuine saturation. He was bringing the sound of New Orleans, his version of it, to this huge general audience. And the industry took notice, too. Back of Town got nominated for the Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Jazz Album.
He definitely kept that momentum rolling with the follow-up album For True, which came out just a year later in 2011. And that one seemed to really double down on his collaborative spirit.
For True really cemented his status as this go-to collaborator, someone everyone wanted to play with. The guest list on that album is fascinating because it spans the spectrum again.
It was on it.
You had traditional New Orleans giants like the Rebirth Brass Band on there, but then also these high-profile rock and blues figures, Jeff Beck returned, Warren Haynes from Govert Mule, and the Allman Brothers, the amazing drummer Stanton Moore from Galactic.
Okay, serious players.
Serious players. But then, in this wild contrast, you also had Kid Rock on a track.
Kid Rock, okay.
Right. And his buddy Lenny Kravitz came back for another guest spot, too. It just proves he could speak the language musically fluently across almost any genre boundary.
And his output as a leader continued steadily after that.
Yeah, the sources track his albums consistently, say this in 2013. Then his debut on the legendary Blue Note label, Parking Lot Symphony, in 2017, which got great reviews. And his most recent, Lifted, came out in 2022.
But maybe the most compelling proof of his universal appeal, his musical adaptability, is looking at the sheer variety of artists he's appeared with as a sideman. When you go through this list we compiled, It's kind of mind-blowing. You realize that almost every single musical genre seems to want a piece of that New Orleans brass energy.
It's an absolutely unprecedented list of genre hopping, really. Yeah. I mean, start with the legends, the Foundations. He recorded with the iconic Dr. John on that song Down in New Orleans, which was nominated for an Academy Award from the Disney movie.
Right, The Princess and the Frog.
Exactly. He's appeared on albums by other New Orleans powerhouses like the funk band Galactic, and then, you know, rock royalty like Eric Clapton. He's played on Clapton's records.
But the ones that really make you do a double take are the unexpected genre crossovers. They're just fantastic.
Aren't they? Like, who would necessarily predict Trombone Shorty recording with the massive country act Zac Brown Band? He's on their track Overnight.
Wow.
And also with another huge country star, Dierks Bentley, on a song appropriately titled Mardi Gras.
Okay, so that shows that brass band energy, that sound, it's now become an accepted, even sought-after element in mainstream country music, too.
Seems like it. And just to cover all bases, for the holiday season, he even popped up on Rod Stewart's Christmas album, Merry Christmas Baby, back in 2012.
Mm, Rod Stewart, too.
But if there was one collaboration that really placed him right at the cutting edge of contemporary pop production, fusing old and new, it probably had to be his work with Mark Ronson.
Ah, right. On Ronson's huge 2015 album Uptown Special, specifically on that big single Feel Right, which featured the rapper Mystical.
Exactly. Mark Ronson is, you know, a master synthesis himself. He takes classic funk, soul, R&B sounds and gives them this incredibly polished modern pop finish. And Shorty's horn playing on Feel Right was absolutely essential to that track. It provided the grit, the power, the necessary New Orleans authenticity to ground all that modern production.
It makes perfect sense.
And then, just to bring it completely full circle, back to the absolute highest tier of rock and roll royalty. The sources note his collaboration in 2021 with Ringo Starr on Ringo's EP Change the World.
Ringo Starr.
Yeah. So think about that arc from being pulled on stage by Bo Diddley as a kid to collaborating with a Beatle decades later.
Yeah.
And hitting pretty much every major genre, rock, pop, funk, country, jazz, R&B along the way. That is just a masterclass in musical versatility and appeal.
Okay, so moving beyond the studio recordings, the albums, the tours, the sources also really detail these moments where Trombone Shorty kind of transcends just being a musician, where he becomes this recognized national cultural figure, an ambassador, really. These are those high-profile performances, the accolades, that show the sheer breadth of his reach.
Yeah, and the frequency of his appearances at, say, the White House alone is pretty remarkable.
He played there multiple times.
Multiple times, just in 2015 for President Barack Obama, including one performance of his track Fia on the Bayou, alongside Usher and Queen Latifah.
Wow, quite a lineup.
Right, and he wasn't just there to perform music. He also participated in a special educational program with First Lady Michelle Obama back in 2012, right there at the White House, which highlights, you know, his commitment to youth outreach was already happening even then.
And the sources mentioned he was back again more recently.
Yep, they confirmed he continued that role with another White House performance noted in 2024 as well.
So these weren't just gigs, right? These feel more like acts of cultural diplomacy almost, showcasing the vitality, the importance of New Orleans music at the nation's highest level.
Exactly. Cultural affirmation is a good way to put it. And his status crossed over into the sports world, too, in a big way.
Right. He performed the national anthem before an NFL playoff game in 2012.
Yep. But maybe the even bigger spotlight came during the Grammy Awards ceremony itself.
Okay. What happened there?
At the 56th Annual Grammy Awards in 2014, he was part of this massive, really talked about performance. He shared the stage with an incredible, diverse group. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis, Madonna and Queen Latifah. They performed a version of the song Same Love.
I remember that performance. It was a huge cultural moment.
It was. And having Trombone Shorty right there playing on that song, it put him squarely into the international pop consciousness, far beyond just the jazz or funk charts.
And he also proved his skills weren't just as a player, but as a leader, a curator, too.
That's right. He served as the actual music director and the primary performer for the halftime show of the 2014 NBA All-Star Game, which happened to be held in New Orleans that year.
Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. And it was clearly his opportunity to really curate this showcase of the city's musical heritage and power. He brought together absolute legends like Dr. John, contemporary stars like Janelle Monáe and Gary Clark Jr., and the iconic funk band Earth, Wind & Fire.
Wow, that's like a dream team of New Orleans and related sounds.
Right. He was effectively acting as the city's cultural emissary on one of the biggest stages in sports entertainment.
And his acceptance, his embrace by the rock community, that continued to grow too, especially after that HBO series Sonic Highways came out in 2014, where Dave Grohl interviewed him.
Yeah, Dave Grohl, obviously a huge figure in rock music with the Foo Fighters. He clearly recognized the deep authenticity, the power in Shorty's music and story.
And that led to them playing together.
It did. Following that interview, Grohl invited Shorty to sit in with the Foo Fighters during this surprise, unannounced gig they played at the legendary Tiny Preservation Hall in the French Quarter.
Wow, that must have been intense.
Can you imagine? And apparently, that collaboration clicked so well that it blossomed into multiple subsequent appearances. Shorty started sitting in with the Foo Fighters at their huge arena shows, too. It's this incredible validation, right? His sound being embraced not just in the funk or jazz world, but at the absolute highest level of modern rock.
And just looking at his touring schedule again, his appeal to really diverse fan bases is so clear. He consistently lands these opening slots for massive, often legacy acts.
Exactly. Like he was the main opener for Hall & Oates on their tour in 2016.
Okay, classic pop rock crowd.
Right. And then just a year later, he secured the entire North American leg opening for the Red Hot Chili Peppers on their 2017 Getaway World Tour.
Huge funk rock band.
Exactly. So it just cements his position as this bridge. Fans of, 70s Philly soul pop and fans of 90s California funk rock, they both recognize and appreciate the energy, the musicianship, the quality that he brings from that deep New Orleans tradition.
It's remarkable reach. And beyond just the performances, he started receiving really significant formal recognition, not just for his music, but specifically for his work in the community, too.
Yeah, the awards he's received are quite significant. Back in 2012, Tulane University gave him their President's Medal. And that honor was specifically tied to his community service work, his philanthropic efforts even then.
Okay, but the really major one, financially and prestigiously, came a few years later.
And that would be the 21st Annual Heinz Award, which he won in the Arts and Humanities category in 2016.
And that's a big deal.
Huge deal. That award comes with a hefty prize valued at $250,000. And the citation, the reason they gave it to him, was very specific. It recognized him for his outstanding achievements as a musician and for his dedicated work in the community to preserve and pass on the rich musical heritage of New Orleans to younger generations.
So it explicitly acknowledged that dual track of his career.
Exactly. Artistic excellence fueled by and feeding back into community commitment, which is really the theme we keep seeing.
He also picked up a Blues Music Award in 2018, specifically in the Blues Instrumentalist Horn category, which again shows that cross-genre respect. And then finally in 2022, he received his first actual Grammy Award, but interestingly, not as the main artist or for one of his own albums.
That's right. He won his first Grammy as a featured artist on an album by his old NOCCA classmate, John Batiste.
Ah.
On Batiste's album, We Are, which famously went on to win the overall Album of the Year Grammy that year.
Wow, what a connection.
Isn't it? It feels like this wonderful full-circle moment of success, connecting him right back to the roots of his own musical education at NOCCA and showing how he continues to be part of and support this rising tide of incredible New Orleans talent hitting the world stage.
And that connection back to the community, that's really where we want to pivot next, because it feels like maybe the most critical element of this whole deep dive. Wouldn't you say Shorty didn't just, take the tradition and run with it globally? He actively built pipelines, institutions to make sure that tradition survives and actually thrives back home.
Yes, absolutely. This is where his legacy really starts to mature beyond just his own performance career. He clearly understood, probably from his own upbringing, that while he might have had access to instruments, mentorship through his amazing family, many other talented young musicians in New Orleans face really significant barriers, especially just getting their hands on quality instruments.
Okay, so tell us about the Horns for Schools project. That sounds like a very direct, very practical way to tackle that specific problem.
It was. It was established in collaboration with the mayor of New Orleans at the time, Mitch Landrieu. And the project's focus, exactly what it sounds like, providing quality musical instruments, horns, specifically directly to schools and individual students across New Orleans.
And Shorty himself was involved?
Oh, yeah, he personally donated instruments to get it started. It addresses this very physical, tangible need. I mean, you can't really join the brass band tradition. You can't learn if you don't have a decent working instrument. So this program helps ensure that young people with talent actually have the basic tools they need to even participate.
That's fantastic, but his commitment pretty quickly went beyond just, donating equipment, right?
Right.
He moved towards establishing something more formal, more enduring, an actual educational infrastructure,
Yeah.
the Trombone Shorty Foundation.
Right. The foundation. That's the real long-term legacy play here. It was established. And then in December 2012, it formed this really key partnership with Tulane University.
Okay, major university.
Exactly. They partnered to create an after-school academy. The focus is specifically on mentoring high school musicians from the New Orleans area.
Why is that partnership with Tulane significant?
Well, it brings together the best of both worlds, really. You get the structure, the resources, the academic credibility of a major university like Tulane, but you combine that with the, street-level, real-world expertise and mentorship provided by Trombone Shorty himself and other professional New Orleans musicians he brings in.
So, what exactly does the Academy teach? Is it just about playing better?
No, it's designed to be much more comprehensive than just performance chops. While high-level musical instruction is definitely a core part, it also explicitly teaches students about the realities of the music business. Things like entrepreneurial skills, branding, navigating contracts, performance techniques needed to succeed in the modern music industry,
Yeah.
not just the local scene.
So it's trying to pass on the whole package.
Exactly. It's an effort to transfer not only that traditional musical language of Tremé in New Orleans, but also the practical knowledge of how to build and sustain a professional, maybe even global, career, just like Shorty himself managed to do.
And his philanthropic work, it wasn't only focused within the city limits or just on music education, was it?
No, absolutely not. Back in 2010, for instance, showing his broader civic engagement, he actually curated this two-night benefit concert series. It was called Red Hot Plus New Orleans, and it took place up at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM.
Okay, and the benefit was for.
All the proceeds were dedicated to raising money for the No AIDS Task Force in New Orleans. So it shows his commitment extended to, general public health and welfare issues facing the city, too.
Finally, we should probably touch on how he's also, in a way, immortalized his own story and the culture of Tremé for the next generation through writing children's books.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful, almost final step in his role as a cultural ambassador. His autobiography, written specifically for young readers, came out in 2015. It's just called Trombone Shorty.
And it was successful.
Hugely successful, not just for the story itself, but also for the incredible artwork. The book was illustrated by Brian Collier, a renowned illustrator, and it was named a 2016 Caldecott Honor Book, which is a huge deal in children's literature.
Wow.
And it also won the Coretta Scott King Award for the illustrator, recognizing the cultural significance and artistic excellence of Collier's visuals, depicting Shorty's childhood and the Terese's environment.
And he wrote another one after that.
Yep, he followed up with the 5 O'Clock Band in 2018. So these books, they ensure that the story of New Orleans music, that early start, the importance of community, the joy of the second line, is accessible and engaging for kids all over the country, influencing them, potentially, long before they ever even think about picking up an instrument themselves.
Well, we have covered a ton of ground in this deep dive into Troy Trombone Shorty Andrews. We've really traced his journey, haven't we? All the way from those deep roots in the Tremé musical dynasty through the early tragedy, the intense mentorship he received, leading up to these massive global collaborations, performing at the White House, and then crucially, institutionalizing his legacy through the Trombone Shorty Foundation.
Yeah, and I think the analysis, when you lay it all out like this, it really shows that Trombone Shorty's journey is, in many ways, kind of the ultimate blueprint for the modern artist who comes from a strong tradition.
So.
Well, he took this singular, incredibly deep-rooted tradition, the brass band music of Tremé, the sound of New Orleans, and he used its power, its authenticity, as this genuine launchpad for massive global multi-genre success.
Right.
But the key is, he succeeded precisely because he never abandoned those roots. If anything, he actively worked to strengthen them through education, through philanthropy, giving back constantly. He really is a living bridge.
That's a great way to put it. An indispensable cultural bridge builder, connecting, the history of jazz, funk, brass bands directly to modern rock, pop, and also to this really significant philanthropic mission. His whole career feels like a masterclass in how you can fuse traditions together without ever losing or compromising their essential core integrity.
And I think that fusion and integrity, that's ultimately why his appeal is so broad, why he connects with people across so many different genres and generations.
So thinking about all this, what does it mean for you, our listener, as you maybe go back and listen to his music after this? We've detailed this just incredible volume of collaborations he's been part of, spanning absolute legends from Bo Diddley and Dr. John all the way to U2, mystical Ringo Starr.
An unbelievable list.
Right. When you consider that enormous range, covering pretty much every musical style imaginable over the last 5-6 decades, it does raise a kind of final, provocative thought for you to ponder. What is it? What is that fundamental, maybe universal quality that's inherent in New Orleans music, you know, that unique gumbo of rhythm, improvisation, history, and that deep communal joy? What is it about that sound that makes it such an essential ingredient, such a desirable component for artists across seemingly every genre and every decade?
That's the magic question.
It is. So we encourage you, go listen to Trombone Shorty's discography, listen to his collaborations, trace those connections we've talked about, and maybe discover the answer for yourself.
Thank you for joining us for the deep dive.
Until next time.